This is Audible.
Blackstone presents Of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why It Matters, and What to Do About It, by Richard V. Reeves. This book is read by Richard V. Reeves.
This book is dedicated to my three sons, George, Bryce, and Cameron. Preface: Worried Dad to Worried Wonk. I have been worrying about boys and men for 25 years. That comes with the territory when you raise three boys, all now grown men. George, Bryce, Cameron, I love you beyond measure. That's why even now I sometimes worry about you. But my anxiety has spilled over into my day job. I work as a scholar at the Brookings Institution, focusing mostly on equality of opportunity, or the lack thereof. Until now, I've paid most attention to the divisions of social class and race, but I'm increasingly worried about gender gaps, and perhaps not in the way you might expect. It's become clear to me that there are growing numbers of boys and men who are struggling in school, at work, and in the family. I used to fret about three boys and young men. Now I'm worried about millions. Even so, I've been reluctant to write this book. I've lost count of the number of people who advised against it. In the current political climate, highlighting the problems of boys and men is seen as a perilous undertaking. One friend, a newspaper columnist, said, "I never go near these issues if I can avoid it. There's nothing but pain there." Some argue that it's a distraction from the challenges still faced by girls and women. I think this is a false choice. As an advocate for gender equality, I think a lot about how to close the pay gap between women and men. For every $100 earned by men, women earn $82. As you'll see, I think the solutions here include a more equal allocation of childcare, helped by generous paid leave for both mothers and fathers. But I am just as worried about the college degree attainment gap in the other direction, which is just one symptom of a large and growing gender gap in education. For every 100 bachelor's degrees awarded to women, 74 are awarded to men. Here I propose a simple but radical reform: start boys in school a year later than girls. In other words, redesign jobs to be fairer to women and reform schools to be fairer to boys. We can hold two thoughts in our head at once. We can be passionate about women's rights and compassionate towards vulnerable boys and men. I am, of course, hardly the first to write about boys and men. I follow in the footsteps of Hannah Rosin, The End of Men, Andrew Yarrow, Man Out, Kay Heimowitz, Manning Up, Philip Zimbardo and Nikita Kulum, Man Interrupted, and Warren Farrell and John Gray, The Boy Crisis, among many others. So why this book, and why now? I wish I could say there was a single, simple motivation, but there are six main reasons. First, things are worse than I thought. I knew some of the headlines about boys struggling at school and on campus, men losing ground in the labour market, and fathers losing touch with their children. I thought that perhaps some of these were exaggerated. But the closer I looked, the bleaker the picture became. The gender gap in college degrees awarded is wider today than it was in the early 1970s, but in the opposite direction. The wages of most men are lower today than they were in 1979, while women's wages have risen across the board. One in five fathers are not living with their children. Men account for almost 3 out of 4 deaths of despair, either from a suicide or an overdose. Second, the boys and men struggling most are those at the sharp end of other inequalities, especially of class and race. The boys and men I am most worried about are the ones lower down the economic and social ladder. Most men are not part of the elite, and even fewer boys are destined to take their place. In 1979, the weekly earnings of the typical American man who completed his education with a high school diploma was, in today's dollars, $1,017. Today, it is 14% lower, at $881. As The Economist magazine puts it, "The fact that the highest rungs have male feet all over them is scant comfort for the men at the bottom. Men at the top are still flourishing, but men in general are not, especially if they are black. To be male, poor, and African American is to confront on a daily basis a deeply held racism that exists in every social institution, writes my colleague Camille Bousset. No other demographic group, she writes, has fared as badly, so persistently, and for so long. Black men face not only institutional racism, but gendered racism, including discrimination in the labor market and criminal justice system. Third, it became clear to me that the problems of boys and men are structural in nature rather than individual, but are rarely treated as such. The problem with men is typically framed as a problem of men. It is men who must be fixed, one man or boy at a time. This individualist approach is wrong. Boys are falling behind at school and college because the educational system is structured in ways that put them at a disadvantage. Men are struggling in the labor market because of an economic shift away from traditionally male jobs. And fathers are dislocated because the cultural role of family provider has been hollowed out. The male malaise is not the result of a mass psychological breakdown, but of deep structural challenges. As the feminist author Susan Faludi writes in her 1999 book, Stiffed, "The more I consider what men have lost, a useful role in public life, a way of earning a decent and reliable living, appreciation in the home, respectful treatment in the culture, the more it seems that men of the late 20th century are falling into a status oddly similar to that of women at mid-century." Fourth, I was shocked to discover that many social policy interventions, including some of the most touted, don't help boys and men. The one that first caught my eye was a free college program in Kalamazoo, Michigan. According to the evaluation team, quotes, "women experience very large gains in terms of college completion, increasing by almost 50%, while men seem to experience zero benefit." This is an astonishing finding. Making college completely free had no impact on men. But it turns out that there are dozens of programs that benefit girls and women, but not boys and men. A student mentoring scheme in Fort Worth, Texas. A school choice program in Charlotte, North Carolina. An income boost to low-wage earners in New York City, and many more. The striking failure of these interventions to help boys or men is often obscured by a positive average result driven by the positive impact on girls or women. In isolation, this gender gap might be seen as a quirk of a specific initiative, but it is a repeated pattern. So not only are many boys and men struggling, they are less likely to be helped by policy interventions. Fifth, there is a political stalemate on issues of sex and gender. Both sides have dug into an ideological position that inhibits real change. Progressives refuse to accept that important gender inequalities can run in both directions, and quickly label male problems as symptoms of toxic masculinity. Conservatives appear more sensitive to the struggles of boys and men, but only as a justification for turning back the clock and restoring traditional gender roles. The left tells men, "Be more like your sister." The right says, "Be more like your father." Neither invocation is helpful. What is needed is a positive vision of masculinity that is compatible with gender equality. As a conscientious objector in the culture wars, I hope to have provided an assessment of the condition of boys and men that can attract broad support. Sixth, as a policy wonk, I feel equipped to offer some positive ideas to tackle these problems, rather than simply lamenting them. There has been enough hand-wringing. In each of the three areas of education, work, and family, I provide some practical, evidence-based solutions to help the boys and men who are struggling most. It is probably worth saying up front that my focus is on the challenges faced by cis heterosexual men, who account for around 95% of men. In part one, I present evidence on the male malaise, showing how many boys and men are struggling in school and college, that's chapter one, in the labor market, that's chapter two, and in family life, chapter three. In part two, I highlight the double disadvantages faced by black boys and men suffering from gendered racism, chapter four, as well as boys and men at the bottom of the economic ladder, chapter five. I also present the growing evidence that many policy interventions don't work well for boys and men, chapter 6. And in part 3, I address the question of sex differences, arguing that both nature and nurture matter, chapter 7. In part 4, I describe our political stalemate, showing how, instead of rising to this challenge, politicians are making matters worse. The progressive left dismisses legitimate concerns about boys and men and pathologizes masculinity, chapter 8. The populist right weaponizes male dislocation and offers false promises, chapter 9. For the partisans, there is either a war on women or a war on men. Finally, in part 5, I offer some solutions. Specifically, I make proposals for a male-friendly education system, chapter 10, for helping men move into jobs in the growing fields of health, education, administration, and literacy, or HEAL, chapter 11, and for bolstering fatherhood as an independent social institution, chapter 12. A man would never get the notion, wrote Simone de Beauvoir, of writing a book on the peculiar situation of the human male. But that was in 1949. Now, the peculiar situation of the human male requires urgent attention. We must help men adapt to the dramatic changes of recent decades without asking them to stop being men. We need a pro-social masculinity for a post-feminist world, and we need it soon.